This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, warnings a possible environmental disaster isn't far away, with thousands of World War II shipwrecks in the Pacific at risk of leaking oil. We'll hear about a new program that's going to try to protect the region, though, from a major spill. Also coming up, how rumours of a tsunami sparked panic in Solomon Islands this week and what lessons must be learnt from it.
Everyone at the main market just ran for their lives, coming this way to the market, and then they were screaming tsunami, so it was like a chain reaction.
There's the question of Ponyera or our main centres need to create alarms whereby it can only be turned on if there's a tsunami warning or there's a tsunami by those in authority.
And Fiji's international soccer star Roy Krishna might now be the best player in Australia's A-League, but how do you get other talented players from the Pacific into Australia's professional ranks?
To be the top goal scorer in the A-League, coming from where he's come from, is just truly exceptional. And there are so many talented athletes in the Pacific region that you just have to look at the number of rugby league and rugby union players, for example. So if soccer gave them the same opportunity, I think there'd be so many come through.
Well, there is a suggestion that a dedicated visa slot could be created to allow A-League clubs for each of them to recruit one player from the islands. But not everyone agrees that that would be the best solution. We'll have more on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, there are new warnings that thousands of World War II shipwrecks in the Pacific containing millions of litres of oil pose a potential environmental disaster. New research has identified around 50 that need urgent action in places like Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea and Marshall Islands. And those involved in a new program say they're in a race against time. Scuba divers are drawn to the Pacific, wanting to see for themselves the graveyard of ships, aircraft and tanks, the telltale signs of the fierce battles of World War II that played out here. It was during his own family diving holiday to Micronesia that Australian man Paul Adams discovered there was more to these wrecks.
Basically, four of the 10 ships that we dived on were leaking oil. That started us on a long trail of research and trying to find out what it was about and who was doing something about it.
Last year, he and his wife, Wilma, bought an old New Zealand warship, renamed it MV Ocean Recovery, and made it their mission to prevent a major oil spill.
It's quite a serious problem. There is huge volumes of oil still in World War II shipwrecks. And pretty much the status quo is, let's wait and see what happens. When we talked to the local villagers up there, they were almost in a depression about what's going to happen when these things break. And it really put a tear in our eyes. It was so close to their thinking that they were sleeping every night with the thought that they may wake up in the morning and their life would be over in that area. The beach would be black, the coral would be gone, they can't go fishing anymore.
It's estimated more than 3,000 ships sank during the war in waters across Asia and the Pacific. Studies have shown they're now coming to the end of their lifespans with their metal walls corroding. Paul Adams and his team at the Major Projects Foundation have spent the past year assessing the wrecks and have narrowed the number down to 55 that they say need urgent attention. They're in waters of countries like Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Palau.
They're what we call our Category 1 wrecks. They got on that list mainly because they're near pristine reef or local villages or fish breeding grounds, mangrove areas, things that if they do go pop, that they're actually going to drastically affect the local communities and corals. There are still a huge number which do have oil, etc. in them, but if they're in deeper waters and the likes, then they're not as urgent.
They're now partnering with the University of Newcastle and the Pacific's leading environmental group, SPREP, to bring scientists, engineers and historians together for a remediation program. Fijian Awai Banivalu is a PhD student at the university and on the team, piloting a process known as bioremediation that could be one of the technologies used to remove the oil.
What we're really trying to do is to look for bacteria, certain bug, that will be able to convert or to eat up this oil and convert them into something that's less toxic to the environment or more environmental friendly. It's not a new concept. It's been there for ages. But with regards to the World War II wrecks, yes, this is the first time.
And for Awai, she says, as a Pacific Islander, it's personal.
The Pacific Ocean is our identity, yeah? And everything to do in the Pacific, that should concern everybody. It's a source of livelihood.
It'll still be around 18 months before Awai and others are able to put their research into action. Paul Adams warns that it could be longer if they aren't able to secure more funding, but he cautions that could have costly ramifications.
Some of these tankers and that out there, we're talking about millions of litres. The cleanup costs will be enormous. It might be $4 or $5 million now to take the oil out. It'll be 50, 60, 70 if we don't. Not to mention the environmental damage, which is irreparable. It's something that needs to be done quite urgently. And we are running out of time. There's no question about that.
That is Paul Adams. He's from the Major Projects Foundation. Ending that report there. There are now calls for improvements in how tsunami warnings are issued in Solomon Islands after a rumour sparked panic in the capital, Honiara, this week, with schools closed and people moving to higher ground to escape. Thousands of residents were affected as police and authorities tried to reassure the public that there was no tsunami to fear. The panic's believed to have started at Honiara Central Market before it was then fuelled by social media, as Evan Wasuka reports.
The central market is located at Honiara's foreshore. It was here that strong winds kicked up higher than usual swells, which swept into the market on Tuesday. Marketgoers fled the area and panic set in. Mary was standing at a roadside market near Chinatown, about half a kilometre away.
Everyone at the main market just ran for their lives, coming this way to the market, and then they were screaming tsunami, so it was like a chain reaction. Everybody just jumped around.
She said panic ensued.
I wanted to find out information whether it was true or not, so I was ringing around trying to get NDC, people that actually could give me the information, because anyone around me like a chook.
When calls started coming in, we started to think about what is going on, what is happening, because actually we did not make any warnings at all. There was no any earthquake.
Manawa Tepa is acting chief forecaster at the Meteorological Office. He's responsible for sending out warnings on earthquakes and tsunamis. Mr. Tepa ended up going on air on Solomon Islands Broadcasting Corporation to reassure the public and tell them that there was no tsunami.
I was really worried because people may jump into some accidents while panicking and running here and there.
But by that time, the story had spread like wildfire across Honiara.
And then there was somebody who posted it on the Facebook, and then it basically went viral. And everybody was basically responding to the fake news as it was a real news. So everybody in the Lanzhou were going up the hills. They were going up to where they have the higher grounds. School kids went up. Even workers went up. So people were actually scrambling. They're actually struggling to climb up the hills.
Robert Iroga is a journalist and owner of the Solomon's Business magazine. He says schools were closed and students moved to higher ground.
There was a lot of panic, and even at the hospital, patients also tried to escape from the hospital, but fortunately they were told that that wasn't the true news, so they stayed on. Otherwise, it could have been a lot more disaster had they attempted to go outside.
As a journalist, Mr. Iroga says he's alarmed at how fast information spread on social media and affected thousands.
How our people responded to the fake news was very concerning, because they have bypassed all the legitimate sources of information, and they have responded quite crazily to what is later found out to be fake news.
In cases of tsunamis, warnings are broadcast on national radio, through SMS text and on social media. But Mr. Iroga says authorities need to put in place sirens to warn the public.
It begs the question of Honiara or Amman centers need to create alarms whereby it can only be turned on if there's a tsunami warning or there's a tsunami by those in authority. For instance, if it can only be turned on by those, the NDMO or those at the Met office, meteorological office. So that itself, it's sort of, it comes from the legitimate people or people in authority who are supposed to give the right information.
That's Robert Tiroga. He's a journalist and owner of the Solomon Business Magazine in Honiara and Solomon Islands. Evan Wasuka reporting there. Well, advocates who'd been pushing to change the name of Cook Islands say they are working now on a compromise solution after facing backlash from the overseas Cook Island community, including here in Australia. The name change suggestion was first announced back in March. The idea was to come up with something that better reflected the nation's Polynesian heritage rather than the name giving a nod to its colonial history. But now, instead of changing the English name outright, the Cook Islands will simply add a traditional name in the Cook Islands Maori language, as Jordan Fennell reports.
Cook Islanders have spent the past 2 months submitting their ideas for renaming their country to the Cook Islands Name Change Committee. That's led to 192 options that the committee has to narrow down to just one. Danny Mataroa, the committee chairman, says the best ones have to be easy to pronounce, have a story, and have a connection to their Cook Islands heritage.
There's one that comes to mind right now is Atea. Simple. It means the whole kingdom of God is here on our island. The whole vastness, the ocean, the skies, the heavens above, the mountains, the birds, everything. It's like the Garden of Eden.
Pa Upokotini, also known as Queen Pa, is a traditional queen in Rarotonga and started the push to officially change the English name this year. The 72-year-old says she's been waiting long enough to see this happen.
I feel that it's timely now. It's time that we need to, have our own local traditional name.
Mr. Mataroa says it's time Cook Islanders show they mean business when talking about keeping their culture alive.
We, at this time in our history, we've been self-governing for 50 years. We should be old enough to make our own decision and change.
But in March, when the news of the potential name change travelled around the world, the overseas communities of Cook Islanders were firmly against the idea. Farina Tuaiti is the culture leader at the Cook Islands Community Services Victoria, based in Melbourne, and says her community voiced their concern.
Yeah, we all, within our community here in Melbourne, we have a small Cook Island community too, how we all get together, go to church and all that. No one agreed. We all thought that was stupid. We thought, what are they thinking? Think that they should focus on better things than trying to spend time to fight or to get a name change?
She says that the Cook Islands name is now part of their identity.
I think it's really wrong. We've been known as the Cook Island for so many years, and we're just so used to having Cook Islands and to change it, and I think it's a wrong move.
Due to the pressure from these communities, the traditional leaders have decided to leave the English name as it is and instead just add on a traditional name. But Ms. Tuaiti says she is against the idea of any name change and says the Cook Islands government should be spending their time and money on more important issues like healthcare.
You notice that a lot of people from the Cook Islands, diabetes and all this stuff and the sickness, most of them are transported to New Zealand. Why? Because the Cook Islands don't have the equipment. They lack on their health, in the hospitals and all that.
Despite the pushback, Mr. Mataroa says there is support for an additional traditional name, and after approval from the Name Change Committee, a proposal and budget for the project has been submitted to the Cabinet for further approval. If it gets the go-ahead, the next step will be to decide the process of how the name will be ratified. And although the idea of a referendum has been floated, Mr. Mataroa prefers consultations with the individual constituencies.
The choosing of the name still comes down to the committee, and that's going to be taken out all around the 25 constituencies in the Cook Islands, the 12 inhabited islands.
He says even though they may potentially get a new additional traditional name, he will never stop fighting to change the English one.
You talk about them sailing the waka, sailing the ocean, using the stars, the moon, the sun, the ocean, the birds, the clouds, the wind direction, and yet our name doesn't say that.
That's Danny Mataroa. He's the chairman of the Cook Island Name Change Committee, and Jordan Fennell reporting there for us. Timor-Leste's ambassador to Australia says that he hopes negotiations over an oil gas field that was at the centre of a bitter maritime dispute between the two countries can get back on track now that the federal election here is over and the coalition government has been re-elected. Abel Katera says his country needs the treaty that defines which oil and gas fields belong to each country. He needs it to be ratified by the Australian Parliament by August. It was delayed because of the election. And because of the delay in ratification, Australia's actually continued to claim a stake in an oil field that actually under the treaty now fully belongs to Timor-Leste. It's estimated it could have generated the smaller country $60 million in the past 12 months, as Girish Salani reports.
In March last year, Australia and Timor-Leste signed a long-awaited treaty at the UN headquarters in New York to settle a decades-old maritime border dispute between the two countries. The treaty confirmed Timor-Leste's ownership of several disputed oil and gas fields, but that agreement is yet to be ratified by the Australian Parliament, and Australia continues to claim a 10% stake in one of the oil fields that, according to the treaty, belongs to Timor-Leste. Last month, former President Jose Ramos Horta said he was confident Australia would return millions of dollars generated from the oil fields. Ratifying the agreement was delayed because of the federal election, and the two countries are yet to agree on where the oil and gas will be processed. Canberra is offering to give 80% of revenue to Timor-Leste if the resources were piped to Darwin. Timor-Leste wants it piped to its shores, while offering to accept 70% revenue. So will negotiations progress now that the coalition under Prime Minister Scott Morrison has been returned to power? Abel Gutierrez is Timor-Leste's ambassador to Australia.
Given that we've signed the treaty agreement, it's remained to be ratified. So we hope that the treaty process can go through and the ratification can take place. Hopefully, if we can align our thinking, both Timor-Leste and Australia, the treaty can be ratified sometimes in August.
And how critical is it for Timor-Leste that this be ratified?
It is important because the ratification would then allow the Banyundan operation to be transferred to Timor-Leste 100%. So this is why it is important to us.
Now, even with the treaty, there is no agreement about where the gas and oil in the future will be processed. Of course, Timor-Leste wants it on its shores. How confident is Timor-Leste that this would happen?
Timor-Leste is confident because the development of Greater Sunrise is to do with joint venture partners. So it is an investment decision. So Timor-Leste government is working, and the Timor Gap, which is the Timor-Leste state oil company, is now working hard to find partners to invest in the development of Greater Sunrise. Along with the joint venture partners Woodside and Osaka, because Timor-Leste is now the majority shareholding in the JVs. But of course, Australia still owns 30%, Timor-Leste 70%.
There were doubts by Australia of Timor's capacity to develop that oil field.
Well, Timor-Leste doesn't have modern technology. So you bring in technology to do the work. You bring in the expertise to do the work, just like Australia does. Or every other country do. You don't have your own technology. You bring in the knowledge, you bring in the technology, the engineers, all that. You bring in those knowledge to develop the results. So, you know, for us, there's no issue in that.
On another issue, during the election campaign, we heard from the Labour opposition of their commitment to raise foreign aid by $1.6 billion over the next 4 years. But, of course, Labour didn't win, and there was no such commitment from the Liberal Nationals coalition. From Timor-Leste's perspective, should Australia raise its level of foreign aid?
Well, I think, you know, there's a need from the developing the small states, you know, surrounding Australia in the Pacific and in Asia and elsewhere where Australia provides support and foreign aid. I'm sure, you know, Australia needs to look after its immediate region. I mean, Prime Minister Morrison visited the Pacific countries before the election, so he knows the need, and I'm sure that those needs and consideration will be taken into account.
It is Abel Guterres. He's Timor-Leste's ambassador to Australia. He was speaking there with Girish Saulani. And Pacific Beat has approached Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for comment, its perspective on the future of the joint oil and gas fields, but we're yet to receive a response. Well, soccer in the Pacific has certainly taken giant strides in recent weeks, with New Caledonia's Hengjin defeating local rivals Magenta in what was the first ever All-Pacific Islands OFC Champions League final. And then Fiji international Roy Krishna won the Johnny Warren medal. That's the prize that's awarded to the Player of the Year in Australia's A-League. And now, as Richard Hewitt reports, the hope is that Krishna's recognition will be able to open the way for other talented players from the islands so they can make their way into Australia's professional ranks. But exactly how can you make that happen?
The winner of this year's Johnny Warren medal is Roy Krishna.
And as Roy Krishna stepped up to collect his award after the thank yous, he offered this simple message.
If you work hard, dreams do come true, so thank you.
And after Krishna's dream came true, the benchmark has been set. Former New Zealand international and former OFC vice president Fred de Jong is in no doubt there is more than one Roy Krishna in the islands. And now he says it's time for OFC to bang the drum.
I don't know that they can bring pressure, but I think they can certainly encourage, especially at FFA and New Zealand football level, and just keep up a dialogue to try and encourage these countries to open up their regulations, because the easier it is for the movement of these players, obviously the better.
Ernie Merrick, who as coach of Wellington Phoenix recruited Roy Krishna into the A-League, wants to see a dedicated visa slot created that would enable A-League clubs to each recruit one player from the islands.
To be the top goal scorer in the A-League, coming from where he's come from, is just truly exceptional. And there are so many talented athletes in the Pacific region that you just have to look at the number of rugby league and rugby union players, for example. So if soccer gave them the same opportunity, I think there would be so many come through.
Fred de Jong points to the existing state of play in New Zealand, where in the semi-professional national league, such a visa system already exists.
In New Zealand, we've now got the import ratio 6-1, one Oceania player. So if the A-League would do something like that, man, that would instantly make the Pacific players much more accessible.
But former Cook Islands national coach Drew Sherman, who's now the man in charge of youth development at the A-League club Brisbane Roar, doesn't believe that dedicated visa places are actually the answer.
To create an artificial sense where 11 clubs for the next season could potentially take one Oceanian player, well, are there 11 Oceanian players that are at that level? Are we actually creating an artificial market for them and a false sense of hope that long-term isn't going to benefit the best of them?
As the A-League apparently moves towards independence from Football Federation Australia, Sherman believes restrictions on player recruitment would be lifted and clubs would be able simply to target the best. Or perhaps, as Fred de Jong suggests, take a chance on a player like PNG international Tommy Semi, who's made a huge impact in New Zealand and would appear ready to step up to another level.
He's a proven goal scorer at New Zealand Premiership level now, and I think he's got the raw materials to go further. He's still very young. He's a guy that, in the right environment, I think could do really, really well.
While arguing for dedicated visa slots, Ernie Merrick also wants to see structural development in the island countries. He says the prospect of both PNG and Fiji launching professional leagues is exactly what's needed to provide player development in the vital mid-teenage years.
Technically, they're all very good. Their ability to control a ball, pass a ball, their speed is phenomenal. Agility, all the physical aspects, technical aspects are there. It's really the strategic areas, but it's really about having a regular competition of such a high standard that it challenges everyone.
And Fred de Jong argues that at junior level, players from New Zealand and Solomon Islands, who will be going to the Under-17 World Cup later this year, are actually on a par with many of the bigger countries. It's at the next stage in the move into professionalism where the gap starts to appear.
The gap gets very big very quickly. The European players are playing at big clubs, and in the next 2 or 3 years, their progress just skyrockets, and we can't match that.
Drew Sherman says success for the Solomons on the world stage would do the islands cause a lot of good at a time when he believes momentum on the soccer fields of the Pacific is growing.
There is starting to be that track record of success, and no longer can clubs turn a blind eye to the nations. Those younger players, if they go and put themselves out there on a true world stage, a World Cup, a World Club Championships, then of course professional clubs are going to sit up and take note.
And that next wave includes Sarpreet Singh at Roy Krishna's club Wellington Phoenix. Singh has Indo-Fijian heritage, but born and brought up in Auckland, he had a clear pathway to the A-League, unlike players in the islands. So, should another Roy Krishna get his chance, Drew Sherman says they'll have to do it the hard way, just like Krishna himself did.
So the sounds of an excited commentator there about Roy Krishna, who certainly is the star from Fiji. Richard Hewitt reporting there. Well, that's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget, Richard Hewitt will be joining you from 3 p.m. PNG time this afternoon. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company. You have a great day.